Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
This episode of Ramble Meets is sponsored by Bet365.
Michael Cox, football journalist and author.
Michael, your website Zonal Marking was set up in January 2010, is that right?
That is correct.
To provide tactical analysis of football matches. What is it that inspired you to make that step into putting some of your ideas out there for public consumption?
Well, my issue was always that I didn't think newspapers covered football matches in a very good way.
Right.
I think newspapers do a lot of good football coverage. Interviews are good. They get stories. There's often good features. But in the modern age, there's no need for traditional match reports. I mean, I haven't gone out of my way to read a match report in years because I've always seen the games as catch up, as clips on Twitter, whatever. You don't need to read what has happened. I think you need to read why it happened. And I followed two sports when I was growing up, football and cricket, and they were completely different in terms of analysis. Cricket, there was always statistical analysis. There was always good tactical stuff. There was always good visualizations. And it taught me stuff about cricket that I didn't know. And I thought that was always lacking in football.
Have you always found it? I mean, I don't expect you to be too self-aggrandizing this early on, but is it something that you thought straight away, I can see what's happening here. I can understand the tactics. I can understand the shape. I can see what the manager and the players are trying to do. Or were you at the very start bluffing it for a while?
I mean, I don't think any of it's complex. I don't think you need to have a particular mind for it.
Right.
You know, I sat with games with a kind of chalkboard and moved the magnets around and found patterns and wrote down everything that happened.
Yeah.
And then you gradually see patterns that, you know, you end up analysing the game rather than just the incidents, you know, just the goals, which can be kind of one-off things rather than something that it was you know, is related to the overall game plan.
And what inspired you to first of all get out there and say, I'm going to set up a website, I'm actually going to do this for people to see? Do you think I'm good at this? I think it can be of real benefit to football fans.
Yeah, I wanted to get into football journalism, and it seemed the obvious way to do it, to put your stuff out there rather than be kind of, you know, doing work experience everywhere, which I did, but,
yeah,
you know, it's a long route to get into where you're actually doing features and stuff. It was like, yeah, this is a kind of interpretation of football writing that isn't out there, really. So just put it out there and see if it gets traction.
And what is it that made you fall in love with football in the first place?
Just playing it at school.
Yeah.
Like, no one in my family's interested in football at all. So, yeah, it was just like you play it in the playground and then you end up following it at higher levels. But, yeah, it was, I kind of had quite almost a removed approach from football because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't from a football family or anything and grew up in like Surrey, South London, so it wasn't a big football area really.
Mm.
So it was always kind of viewing it as a slight outsider, if that makes sense.
Yes. So you felt like you were outside looking in and you found it interesting as an outsider.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Were you surprised with the reception you got from your original blog? Can I call it a blog now? Is that old fashioned?
Well, no one called. Yeah, people don't really do blogs anymore. No,
website,
do they?
I guess. Website.
Yeah.
Were you surprised with the positive reaction you received from it?
Yeah, a little bit. I was very lucky. So I started doing that in 2010, and I don't know if you remember, but the World Cup coverage, the television coverage in 2010, was as bad as it's ever been.
Right. So that was the nadir, was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that got a lot of traction. It was also the first time where it's probably the first tournament where people were using Twitter, for example.
Yeah.
And I think people were seeing a very obvious contrast between, you know, the coverage they were getting on television, and then you could follow these kind of weird, wonderful journalists from around the world who would give you insights. And there was suddenly a big, I think a lot of people in television and radio maybe realised, actually, we have to up our game here. And over the next couple of years, you saw the level of punditry rise with, for example, the introduction of Gary Neville, which I think was a big moment in terms of improving the analysis on television.
And it's kind of interesting because looking back at some of that those early entries and the articles that you wrote, it was the start of the time, I feel like, I don't think I've got my dates wrong here, where the general consensus was that people's attention spans were getting shorter and short form thing was the way to go, and people just wanted to watch excuse me, minute long videos. And I used to go to meetings with commercial people. They go, we want snackable fun. We don't want anything too long. What, your podcast was an hour long? That's a disgrace. But a lot of your articles are quite long form, quite in depth. So there must have been a little bit of surprise that it was being consumed in such numbers. Or did you just not have anything to base it on? So you just like, I don't want to backfill the narrative. It just was what it was.
I don't know. I'm not even sure I thought about that. But the attention span thing's interesting because I remember that. Yeah, I remember like, you know, when I was first getting into it and everyone was saying that. And now, obviously, it's a different world, but like people are watching Game of Thrones for 10 hours straight.
Yeah, I know. It's Well, Netflix seems to have changed the game a bit on that because people will binge watch stuff, won't they?
Yeah. So I'm not sure that kind of bite-sized thing turned out to be true. But yeah, it was long and it was in depth, but it was, yeah, that's how I thought stuff needed to be consumed. And if you're talking about tactics, I'm not sure it works in a paragraph.
No. Well, I guess it might even be impossible. So we talked about how you got into it, and you said to me before we came on today that you've really enjoyed this season in terms of the football that's been played. Yeah. How different now is football in 2019 to when it was when you first started treating it as a job?
Yeah, really different. I mean, the speed of change in football is absolutely incredible.
And is it getting faster, like the expansion of the universe?
Yeah, I think that is true. I mean, the thing that has changed the game in the last few years is the rise of pressing. And there's so many different things that are going on that I don't think people talk about in terms of what players are doing without the ball. The sophistication with how teams form kind of pressing traps and try to get the ball back. And it's not just about man marking players. It's about pressuring players from different angles. It's really quite a different world, I think, from 2010 when I first started doing it, when, you know, the side that won the European Cup was Mourinho's Inter, who would just sit deep. You don't really get big teams playing like that anymore. It's really changed an incredible amount.
And do you think it runs to the idea that even the really talented footballer coming through now wouldn't be able to become a top-level professional if they didn't have the athletic capacity that was needed for the demands of the modern game?
I think that's true, but I think also in terms of, you need to be tactically intelligent and you need to work as a team. You need to be doing things that you won't get praise for from supporters in the stands because they don't necessarily know what the game plan is. And sometimes you see managers going crazy at players and you almost can't work out why, because they seem to be doing all right.
Yeah.
But they're not doing quite simple, obvious things that they've been told beforehand that aren't obvious to us. So that's one of the challenges, is at the end of the day, you don't know what the manager said. You can't completely analyse every individual player without knowing what their instructions are.
Yeah, and I suppose the vast majority of people will never know. They'll go home after the game or after they've watched it on the TV, and after a while they may not think of that game again. So they'll never know what the team was trying to do. Excuse me. And so that connect between what you're interpreting the manager's asked them to do and the fan, it's kind of the area in which you sit, right?
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes you'll see an incident in a game where, for example, someone plays a pass in behind and he gestures at a player who wasn't making a run. And that player's like 40 yards behind the play. And you think, well, how can you have made that run?
Yeah.
But maybe they'd worked on the day before on that specific move and he wasn't in that position.
Yeah.
So sometimes you don't know who's got that wrong.
And I remember when I was a kid, I used to be quite into basketball around when the Chicago Bulls were brilliant in the early 90s, right? And we went on holiday to the US with the family. And I remember just catching some news, sports news kind of segment on the TV, because they were way ahead of us with that kind of stuff. And there was a thing, I think it might have even been a Chicago Bulls player, I forget which one, who just, he passed the ball, but he just passed it straight off the court.
Okay.
And it became quite a interesting sort of discussion point. And then he was interviewed and they said, why did you do that? And he said, well, the guy should have been there.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you're talking about, right? That's the tactical side of the game that you're talking about.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, I mean, teams work so much on passing patterns, on pressing patterns, and it is quite sophisticated. And you do see sometimes, and for example, English football isn't at the top in terms of tactical sophistication. So when you had the lad, Oliver Burke, who went to, was it Leipzig?
Yeah, he went overseas for sure. A couple of years ago.
And his manager, when he got there, said his understanding of pressing, we're having to start him from zero.
Right.
And I thought, and it was a real
damning indictment of his previous manager.
Well, exactly. But it's quite interesting that you wouldn't usually hear that phrase about a professional footballer starting from zero.
No.
But he was having to learn completely new concepts.
And so not just the athletic ability it's needed now, but then the intelligence as well. Do players need to be more intelligent than they probably were 20 years ago?
I think so. And I think we're at an interesting point where teams are increasingly using data to measure performance, as I'm sure everyone's read about. And I think there's a debate now, how much are you giving that data to the player and in what form? Because some players understand data, they like visualizations, and some it just doesn't work for them. And I think that's, it's one of the many things of managing a professional side, is you've got to treat players in different ways according to their, their demands.
And there will be certain players that aren't compatible with certain managers for that reason, right? So I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that part of the reason that Aaron Ramsey's moving on from Arsenal to go to Juventus is because Emery's not convinced that he can interpret the role that Emery wants him to interpret. And that could be that he can't process the information, right? I'm not saying it is, but it could be that, right?
Yeah, for sure. There's certain managers who, don't want players to express themselves. They want them to kind of carry out tasks. And I'm not sure whether that is the case with Ramsey, but you see it with lots of managers and lots of players. The player is clearly very good, but are not doing the things the manager wants.
I spoke to Jonathan Wilson as well for this series, and I think we discussed either on the episode itself or off air that if you accept that different, and this is something Jonathan said, I think it's in one of his books, if you accept that players adopt certain positions, at that very basic level, you adopt the idea that tactics are important and need to be important. But you have received a decent amount of backlash over the years, it's fair to say, from people in football who have seen your coverage of football as being overly cerebral. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the mistake that's often made is I'm not saying that this is football. I'm not saying football is just tactics and strategy. But so much of football coverage focuses upon desire, upon physical ability, on team spirit, on motivation, on that kind of thing, that I've just tried to play a balancing role. Actually, the tactics are important. This is what the managers are paid to do. They scout opponents for hours and hours and hours and then go onto the training pitch and formulate specific plans to take advantage of weaknesses. Mm. And that wasn't really being spoken about. It probably is now. I think there is a good level of tactical analysis out there. So I wouldn't start writing about tactics in the same way today, because I think it's almost covered.
Yeah, it kind of developed a us versus them type thing, wasn't it? Like, you're either a proper football guy or you were... And it's basically bound up, I don't propose to get into this in any depth really, but it's bound up in this kind of anti-intellectual attitude towards football. Yeah. I think it was Simon Cooper who said that for English football to succeed, they need to embrace the middle class, because all they do is take their players from working class backgrounds, and that's seen as football's environment. And there's definitely an anti-intellectual strain to the game, isn't there? Which I admit, with people like Guardiola and other managers coming in, it's probably changing. But do you think that's still prevalent in the game?
Yeah, I think so. And there was a bit of a backlash. I remember...
Owen Coyle, the big Coyley.
Owen Coyle was a big one. So there was a point where Owen Coyle was basically being touted for the Arsenal job.
Right.
Which I found very odd, because Bolton scored a couple of really good team goals that season.
Right. And that was what it took, was it?
Pretty much. And I did an article that was... And, you know, looking back, this was not sophisticated stats at all, but it was the first time really that stats were publicly available. And I looked at the stats and they had... one of the lowest possession shares, one of the lowest pass completion rates. The things that they did very well were aerial duels, tackles, blocks. Mm. So this wasn't a manager that was suited to Arsenal. So I did an article about that. And then someone, I think for 442 magazine, put the stats to Coyle, and he was very unhappy about this characterisation.
I mean, I've got the quote if you want it.
Yeah, go on.
That Mark Davis goal against Blackpool was an unbelievable footballing goal. I don't know if Zone or whatever saw that. We get our pro zone stuff every week, and I can assure you we pass the ball a lot more. Zone or whoever, good luck to him. Your facts and stats will tell you anything you want, but nothing can beat the naked eye in football.
Well, the thing I like that is it's got zonal whatever and zonal whoever.
No, yeah.
But the thing is, if the first word is zonal, you don't really get it. There's only one zonal phrase in football, isn't there?
I know.
But the thing is, I wasn't even saying he was a bad man. Like, he was doing a good job at that point with Bolton. But I thought that was an example of how you see the two goals on Match of the Day and they look like a great footballing team. Mm. But actually the stats, I wasn't watching every Bolton game at that point. Very few people are, with the exception of Bolton fans. But if you look at the stats, you compare it to other teams in the league and they were far more like kind of Pulis's Stoke than they were an Arsenal.
And it's not as though you're even saying, you've not come from a position where you're saying, Owen Coyle at Bolton, he's doing it all wrong. It's not how you do it. You do it like this and he should listen to me. You're not even saying that. You're just giving people information if they want to consume it, and if they don't have to, that's fine. Yet it comes across like he's a little bit insecure about it. Maybe protesting a bit too much there.
A little bit, yeah. And you're right on that. It wasn't even a criticism of his style of management. I mean, Pulis at the same time was playing an even more raw form of football that was being very successful, but you wouldn't have had him touted as Arsenal manager. It just wouldn't have made sense.
No. All right. Listen, let's take a little break. And after that, we'll talk a bit about your books, plural, including the new one that's coming out. And so don't go anywhere.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Welcome back to this episode of Ramble Meets with Mr. Michael Cox. Michael, you in 2017, you turned your, you'd been writing articles for The Guardian for some time, of course, and for ESPN, but you turned your writing skill, shall we say, into your first book, The Mixer, which is about the history of Premier League football. Is that right?
Yeah.
What inspired you to want to do that, and how did you find the process?
I just always wanted to do books, really. I think that was, you know, as you said earlier, it's kind of long form writing that I do. I think it's much more suited to books than it is to newspaper articles, which often have to be a little bit, they have to be snappy. Sometimes they have to be addressing the story. Mm. I think it was, no one had really written about the development of the Premier League in a footballing sense. There've been lots of books about the business side of it, which is interesting, but it's not what I'm interested in football. Yeah. I'm not interested in finance and that kind of thing. I'm interested in what happens on the pitch.
Yeah.
So, it was addressing something people hadn't covered.
And what is the story? People will go out and pick up the book, I'm sure, but what is the story of the Premier League in a few short sentences?
It's basically been about the internationalisation of the league. I mean, the first ever Premier League match day in August 1992, there was 11 foreign players in the entire league.
That's incredible, isn't it?
1992. And then in Boxing Day 1999... Chelsea fielded 11 foreign players in the same team.
And it only took 7 years for that to happen. That's
7 years. Yeah. And people of our generation kind of take that for granted. It's just something that's happened. And I think it has fundamentally changed the way the Premier League has played. But that is an incredible development in such a short period of time. And then we subsequently saw the internationalisation of managers, which happened a little bit later. And even now in foreign owners. So by far the most international domestic league of any sport in the world, and that is partly why it's become so popular, and that manifests itself in seeing an incredible range of styles amongst the top teams in the Premier League, because you've got managers from 6-7 different countries who kind of all bring something different to the party.
So it's basically what you're talking about then is the internationalisation of the game, but via an explosion of fresh, completely new ideas and ways of looking at the game.
Yeah, and the evolutions have almost always come from a foreign manager or foreign player coming in and doing something completely differently. So Wenger's the obvious example with Arsenal in the 90s. But then there was a massive shift, I think, when Mourinho and Benitez arrived in 2004, both as European winners. And the game became so much more tactical and so much more defensive and so much more strategic. And I think there was another big shift in 2016 with Guardiola coming, with Klopp coming. Klopp's first full season with Conte coming, you saw again a completely different approach to the structure of teams. And there's been very few, I'd say probably only two or three genuine British revolutionaries in the Premier League years.
Who would they be?
I think one is Ferguson, in terms of the sense that he was always in Britain, but he incorporated foreign ideas at an earlier stage, because there was a point where in the old format of the European Cup, he was the only one. United were the only team in the European Cup, basically. Mm. And he was learning lessons from Barcelona, from Milan. I think another was Rio Ferdinand, who people underestimate in terms of, people used to speak about him how they spoke about John Stones a couple of years ago. Like, this is a guy who is not a natural defender. He's a ball player. He's bringing the ball out from defence. People weren't really accustomed to that. And the other one, who people might kind of laugh at, but Brendan Rodgers at Swansea, played a completely different brand of football from anyone else in the Premier League. They came up from the Championship and they were recording the highest possession share in the league, which was a remarkable commitment to possession football at a time where that was the dominant way to play with Barcelona, with Spain. But apart from that, it's generally been, you know, a manager arrives from abroad, introduces a new idea. 3 or 4 years later, people have caught up and that manager kind of starts to decline. It's been a very, it's almost like an arms race. It's been fascinating.
Why do you think people would laugh when you mention Brendan Rodgers? Because he's a bit of a kind of risible person, or?
Well, because I think he's seen as almost a bit of a, almost a bit of a joke figure. And people think that Liverpool failing to win the league in 2014 was a massive failure on his behalf. And maybe he did make some errors, but they started as fifth favourites to win the title. So to even come in with a chance of doing that. And then when you look at what he achieved with Swansea, taking them up with such a commitment to that style of football, and what he did at Celtic, which, you know, is not the most competitive league, but basically won everything he could possibly win. I think he's an excellent manager. I think Leicester have done very well to get him.
And the other two you mentioned, Rio Ferdinand, obviously is a player, so that's a little bit different. Is it possible for a player to really affect the game in such a way? I mean, because we're talking about ideas here, and Rio Ferdinand executes all these ideas, obviously, on the pitch via a manager. So are you simply saying that it became possible for an English centre-back to be a ball-playing centre-back?
Yeah, to a certain extent. But I think when people talk about football tactics, they think it's only about management. It's only about coaching. The players can equally be revolutionary. The key figure in the development of the Premier League, in my opinion, is Eric Cantona, because he came to England and he played a kind of number 10 role at a time when teams weren't really playing with that kind of player. And you saw in the next couple of years, everyone tried to get their equivalent. You saw Arsenal get Bergkamp, you saw Chelsea get Zola, you know, even players like Kincladze and Juninho. And a lot of the time, managers were literally saying, yeah, we need a kind of Cantona figure. And so he was the guy who kind of kick-started the Premier League's tactical and technical development, really. And, you know, you saw that later with someone like Thierry Henry, I think completely changed the way people talk about centre-forwards. It was interesting when I was researching Henry and I went back to, you know, there was a debate between him and Van Nistelrooy, and a lot of established pundits are saying, Henry's great, but he's not really a forward. Van Nistelrooy is a proper striker. But now there aren't too many strikers like Van Nistelrooy who just score goals.
No.
You expect players to be like Henry, to drift wide, to come short, to assist players. So, you know, Omri is another example of a player who I think really changed perceptions of his position.
And what's the legacy that Alex Ferguson leaves tactically? We know him as a winner, and we know him as a guy who takes, as you mentioned, takes ideas from other European clubs. And his great ability was one to be able to adapt, right, and reinvent teams. What's his legacy, other than just being a serial winner that everyone finds synonymous with trophies?
Well, I think it's a really good question, because he was much more advanced tactically than I think people recognize.
Right. I had a conversation with, I think, Andy Brasso, who said, one of the guys we worked with said, you know, this Real Madrid team who's just won three European Cups or whatever in 4 years or whatever it is, they haven't changed the game in any way.
No.
So can they be seen as a great team?
Yeah.
And I wonder, I don't think it will be immediately apparent to everyone listening, and possibly even to myself, that what's changed when Ferguson finished, what his legacy, what he leaves behind.
Well, the thing is, he was there for so long that I think he changed things within his career. So the Cantona thing, as I just mentioned, was a different way of playing in English football.
But he describes that as quite an opportunistic move to get a player who was available and he felt like he needed some star quality. It wasn't a tactical thing, I don't think, where he said, we need a number 10 and he's the best one, so we're going to go and get him. Is that fair?
Oh, it is fair. I mean, they were in the market for kind of David Hurst.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Alan Shearer as well.
Shearer, yeah. So it was a slightly coincidental thing. And I think football has changed. I think at that point it was the players who were interpreting roles, you know, as I say with Cantona. But later on, he makes a very obvious decision that we're going to go from 4-4-2 to playing with only one up front. So they brought in Veron and Van Nistelrooy in the same summer, and basically decided the formation first and then went to get the players.
Right.
And then later on, and that didn't initially work particularly well. I mean, they didn't win the league that season, but there was subsequently a big shift towards playing one up front in the Premier League. And then later, when he gets in Carlos Queiroz, who was always committed to playing almost without a fixed striker. And you saw that in their run to the European Cup in 2008, and they got to the final the next year, where you don't know who the forward's going to be. Sometimes it's Rooney, sometimes it's Tevez.
But do you think Ferguson saw out Queiroz and thought, this is a guy whose ideas I like and I'd quite like to play in this style, and he's going to be able to help me implement it?
He's incredibly complimentary about Queiroz. He says he's a football genius. He took all the training ground sessions and was formulating the team. Ferguson was picking the team and doing the motivation and still obviously playing a huge role. But in terms of, you know, if you'd come into that club without knowing who they are, you'd think Queiroz was the manager. And you see that at other clubs. You saw it with Blackburn in the 1990s. Dalgleish wasn't doing any coaching. It was all Ray Harford. Mm. So a lot of the time, these clubs are more characterised by the assistants than they are by the manager. Of course, the manager's choosing to bring in the assistants. But I think Ferguson recognised that Queiroz was, you know, a very, very good tactical manager, but someone who, if he didn't get to the top as a manager in his own right, is because he didn't have that relationship with players. So Ferguson was doing that role and Queiroz was the tactical guy.
It's quite interesting that a man so successful would know and have the humility to be able to implement that kind of strategy, because he went through quite a lot of different assistant managers famously.
Yeah.
Yet he knows what he's good at and what he's not good at, and that's probably the key to why he was so successful. Because in his first book, the one that is actually good, which goes up to and ends in 1999, it's not really very tactically in depth, and that might be a conscious decision, but he does talk a lot about things like, we knew we could exploit that area of their team, and we knew that Ryan Giggs was in brilliant form this week and or this month, and so we did. And but beyond that, he doesn't really strike me as someone who's a hugely deep thinker about tactic. Same with Brian Clough, really, as well.
Yeah, I mean, not in that Ferguson book, but what I didn't realise until I researched the first book was, for I think 3 or 4 years in the 90s, he brought out like a diary of a season, and it's not like, it's not narrative, it's not an autobiography, it's literally just, this is what I did this day, this is what I did the next day, and it's really in depth, you know. And it's a time where, you know, we don't know so much about foreign sides, and he's up against like Fenerbahce, and he flies over to Turkey and was like, called JJ Kocha, he's incredible, we're gonna have to get someone to mark him,
right?
And so there's, you see a lot more of the in-depth tactical thinking that maybe doesn't make it to a kind of broader, you know, a book that's aimed at a broader market who don't care about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But his fascination with the way Milan play, the way Barcelona play, and Ajax is the other side that he's learning off, is quite interesting. It's like he's speaking about a different world, because English football had been so behind the times. It had literally been banned from European competition for 5 years.
And the transmitting of ideas was a lot more difficult then as well.
Exactly. And so he's the guy who's ahead of the game because he's directly learning off these sides. You know, United are going over to Barcelona getting spanked 4-0, and he's like, okay, well, we've got to change, we've got to keep the ball. There's one quote I really like where he says, he's just talking about the importance of midfield, and he's saying all these foreign sides, they try and keep the ball in midfield.
Yeah.
Like in England, we try and get it out of the midfield, we get it wide and get it out front.
Yeah.
But these sides are actually, they're playing 1-2s.
Yeah.
They're holding possession for the sake of it.
Yeah.
And you see this kind of really fascinating learning curve, I guess, for someone who was, even at that stage, you know, the most revered manager in England.
And ironically, despite how great he clearly was, he's one of the biggest chasms between tactical systems in my rudimentary sort of understanding of it would be in that, hopefully you'll agree, would be in that Champions League final between Man United and Barcelona.
Yeah.
Where they just, we just could get nowhere near them. And it was kind of interesting because after the game, I think it was Darren Fletcher maybe, and Alex Ferguson himself, just didn't really have any answers at all in the post-match interviews about what had just happened, and they couldn't really do anything else but be complimentary. And at that point, is that the kind of, we talked about the nadir of tactics maybe, but is that the apex of what you think can be achieved in tactical football, the Guardiola's Barcelona in that time?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting game actually, because those two final defeats, actually, because United had often played defensively to get to those finals.
It's 2009 we're talking about there, was it?
2009, so yeah, they lost the first final.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Ferguson says something, I think it was in his second kind of major book, and he was talking kind of about parking the bus, and he said something along the lines of, we knew that playing defensively was the best way to try and beat Barcelona, but I wanted to win a final playing our way.
Yeah.
Which I think is really interesting, because people think of him as just a pragmatic, let's win the game, let's win the trophy. But clearly there was something in him that wanted to kind of put on a show. And I wonder whether it's because when you look at the two European Cups they did win, one was 99 in against Bayern, where basically they got spanked you know, had an incredible comeback. And the other one was on penalties against Chelsea.
Yeah.
And they hadn't really put on a show in terms of the way Milan did in 94, the way Barcelona did. So there was something within him that wanted to be
a part of that wanted big, to be rich a part narrative. Of
yeah, wanted yeah. to be the entertainers, and maybe wanted to kind of, you know, have one particular game that people remembered his sides as. But in terms of his legacy, I think it's interesting because obviously United, in various ways, are desperately harking back to that Ferguson era now in terms of, well, in terms of getting Solskjaer in. But it's tough to actually say what United's style was under Ferguson, because it changed so much.
The only thing I can think of, which is, I suppose, possibly even the cliched thing is, you know, attacking football, play with wingers, and I remember watching them and hardly ever not being entertained. But that's not really a tactical style, is it?
But I think they were entertaining because they had a habit of kind of playing rubbish and coming back to win games.
Yeah.
I don't remember, if you think about the kind of debates they had against other sides, you know, when there was two going for the title, when it was them against Newcastle, Newcastle were the entertainers.
Mm.
When it was him against Wenger's Arsenal, Arsenal were the footballing side.
Mm.
Mourinho's Chelsea would be the exception because they were very defensive.
But when Mourinho first came in, they were less defensive than he's kind of been tagged with now.
I think he was. I mean, his first Chelsea side, when they won the league in 2004-05,
yeah,
that was very defensive.
Do you think so? Okay.
I mean, they conceded 15 goals.
Sure. But I know that means they were defensively good, though, not they necessarily sure. defensive style.
Sure. I mean, I think they ended up being a lot more defensive than he wanted them to be.
Okay.
And one of the things for this bit was interesting. I went back and I watched a lot of Porto games, Mourinho's Porto, and they were a brilliant footballing side. Mm. And in their 13 Champions League games that year, when they won it in 2004... 10 of the 13, they dominated possession. Home and away against Real Madrid, home and away against Manchester United. Mm. The only exceptions were in games where they went ahead early and the other side came into it.
Mm.
So, I mean, I agree. I think Mourinho has become more and more defensive, but I can't really make a case for his first Chelsea side being entertainers.
Okay. Well, let's talk about your new book then. It's in what I would describe as a brand power move. You've called it zonal marking.
Yeah.
And it's the making of modern European football.
Yeah.
Apparently, by all accounts, a bit of a pig to research, and it took you a long time to write it. So why should people read it?
I think it's the most comprehensive guide to how football's played in the modern era.
From when does it start? What year does it start?
So it starts as football did in 1992.
because this is presumably because of the back pass rule, the Premier League, and these big things that happened around that time.
Yeah, I think there's been two constants in terms of the evolution of the game since 92. One is the speed of the game, and two is the fact that players are kind of all-rounders now.
And the Bosman, does that come into it?
But there's a little bit of Bosman, yeah.
Hmm.
But it's really kind of an on-pitch thing.
Right.
But those two change, the kind of speed of the game and the kind of defenders having to play out and forwards having to press, I think they were sparked by the back pass change.
Right.
In different ways. So yeah. I think that is the kind of start date of modern football.
Hmm.
And it was quite, you know, people think that the writing of books about the writing.
Mm.
But I think really it's about, one, the research, and two, about the structure of the book.
Mm.
And so the structure of this book is, it's not just saying, it's not 25 disparate chapters. It takes each league in turn.
Yeah. I've spent a bit of time with it. It's interesting because you start off with the Netherlands in 92 through to 96. It's kind of a 4-year thing. So you do Netherlands, then Italy, then France.
Yeah.
Portugal, Spain, Germany, and very optimistically from 2016 onwards, you'd go for England. So portent of perhaps what's to come for English football.
Well, yeah, that was the one league I hadn't cut. I mean, I'd done that for the first book, so I was unsure whether I needed to cover it for this one.
Yeah.
And it was, in the end, I was like, okay, we'll just do an English section for 2016.
Need to get the workout up.
To now, well, actually, it was the opposite. I was trying to bring it down so that section shorter.
Okay, right.
But the funny thing was, that was, when I came up with that, that was going on a bit of a whim, saying that this is the English era.
Hmm.
But then this season, I've been like, you know, like people maybe of our parents' generation who just support any English club in Europe.
Yeah.
Because I've been desperate for that to make sense.
Yeah.
And now we've got two games left, the Europa League final and the Champions League final, and it's all English sides.
Yeah.
So it's worked out absolutely brilliantly for the book. I've been getting behind every English side whenever I can.
And everyone's made what you're saying really is that within Europe, in this era, every country has made its own unique contribution to what the football it looks like now.
Yeah, completely different styles. And I think that's something, again, living in Europe and living in one of these kind of big European countries in a footballing sense, we kind of take for granted.
Mm.
So I was chatting a while back to an American guy who was into football, was into soccer, and he was talking about, and I know very little about the US national team, but he was talking about how people were saying Mexican players brought a different style to the US. And he was like, how can this be? This is just, they're just from a different country. And he was almost talking about it as if it was kind of xenophobic. I know nothing about this debate, but it's very clear to us living in Europe that there's a Spanish style, there's an Italian style, there's a Dutch style.
And that's
the most interesting thing about football.
Does it become a reflection of the national psyche, or is that too far? Is that taking it too far, would you say?
No, I think it is. And I think when you read a book about Italian football, Dutch football, it's always about that. It's always kind of rooted in the culture of a country. I tried to stick to it just being a footballing book. I wasn't trying to explain what Italy is like or what Holland is like, because not my place to do it. But yeah, there's certain things where you can see the culture of a country kind of manifests itself in its football style. And I think it's really interesting. People take it for granted. People, you know, I think football's often patronised a lot in terms of it being kind of a useful cultural artefact, if that makes sense. But when I was growing up, the first thing I knew about the concept of Holland was like learning about total football.
Yeah, it's a big pathway for people.
Then you learn about, oh, Dutch liberalism. And when I was a kid, I'd know nothing about Catalan independence movement if it wasn't for reading a book about Barcelona. Mm. And I'd know nothing about multiculturalism in France if it wasn't for all the stories about the 98 World Cup winning side and them coming from, you know, different places around the world. So it's been, I think football's just such a valuable way to find out more about the world. And like I say, that's not really what the book's about. It's about footballing style, but, you know, there's roots of that in it.
And it's a tricky path to go down, but I want to go down it anyway. This idea that, and we've agreed there, that every country that you've listed in this book, the major footballing nations, which I think is fair in Europe, has made a contribution. Now, it'd obviously be impossible to say whether they've all made an equal contribution, but there is a feeling in football that there's a right way of playing and a wrong way of playing.
Yeah.
And as someone who is adept at analysing tactics and styles of play, I mean, where do you sit on that particular debate? Do you find that sort of unbelievably snobby, or do you think that there is really, football should be a certain thing?
No, I like the variety of styles, but I'd also prefer to watch attacking football. So if I'm watching a team 38 games a season, I'd rather play like Barcelona than Stoke.
But some people find Barcelona, that vintage Barcelona side, boring, like metronomic.
Sure, and I do get that. I do get that. But I like the variety of styles. It's interesting for me. If every side played like Barcelona, it'd be boring. Mm. When you get a Barcelona against Stoke, not that that game has ever happened, but equivalents. You know, when you got City and they're running, we're going away to Burnley, for example.
Yeah.
And that, for me, that's really interesting because City are having to deal with things that they don't want to be doing. That's not how they're
set. But that's
up.
A clash of styles though, right?
Sure.
I'm trying to drill down into the idea of what is the... I mean, maybe the answer is, you don't know what you're talking about, Luke. There is no answer to this. But I want to ask anyway, what is the kind of right way to play? Because, or is it just in the eye of the beholder completely?
I think it's in the eye of the beholder. So in the book, there's some interesting stuff about Italian football, for example, which is traditionally very defensive. Hmm. And the period in the book that I focus on in the mid to late 90s is all about rolling back the changes that Sacchi had made. So Sacchi was brought in a completely more attacking style of
football. With this Dutch influence, as opposed to the Catenaccio kind of style.
So he hated Italian football, like you say.
Yeah.
Loved Dutch football, tried to make Italian football more Dutch, and succeeded with his own Milan side. But people thought it was like an affront to Italian traditions. And you see the complete rolling back of everyone goes from zonal defence to playing man-to-man. Everyone goes from playing high up the pitch to defending deep. And by the end of the era, they appoint Trapattoni, who's obviously the most old school coach.
Yeah.
And it's regional. It's diverse across European styles. And everyone wants to be proud of their own country and its traditions, you know? And you see that now with, I think more than ever, football clubs are saying, we have an identity, we have a brand. Again, to go back to United, we've got to play the Manchester United way, almost above the kind of winning thing.
The West Ham have been saying that since the 60s, really, haven't they?
Well, exactly. Well, that's the funny thing. It used to be two or three clubs would have...
Yeah.
There'd be a bit of a thing about old West Ham think that they play their way. But now you see it with clubs who I can't define this. So I'm unaware of them having a style over the years, but they're like, oh, we've got to be true to our style. And Chelsea, I think, is the interesting one, who are kind of the opposite, who are like an Italian club, who like their fans don't want this possession football that Sarri plays, by and large. They hate it. They are accustomed to sitting deep, counter-attacking. They find it really funny that Arsenal think they play good football and then don't win the trophies.
Yeah.
That's the role that Chelsea
Mourinho
taken
would
on.
Mourinho, and that's partly why Mourinho and Chelsea's sort of history are so intertwined, right? Because Mourinho would say, as he said when Ajax were knocked out of the Champions League a month or two ago, you know, they can sit at home on the sofa and watch the final with their philosophy. Which I thought was a magnificent quote. But that's why he's bound up with them, because he's really just, look, let's just win these trophies. Let's take this club who've not had a tradition of winning anything and get them winning things. Because majority of people listening will be based in the UK, what would you say is the English style then? Because I remember Jack Wilshere a while ago saying something which I think people rolled their eyes at, which was, it was when he was still part of the England squad, and he was saying, you know, we have to understand what we're good at in England. We're good at tackling, and we're good at running fast, and we're good at this, and we're good at that, and we're good at... I can't remember exactly what he said, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Is that unfair to English football to say that's the contribution that they can make?
No, I don't think it is. I actually think...
Should that be seen as somehow less valued than the other contributions?
No, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out. I mean, first, I actually think Wilsh is quite interesting when he talks about football. I think he's quite an interesting, perceptive guy in a footballing sense. And that was a time when everyone was insisting we had to play possession football. We had to play Spanish.
Because we were copying the trendy thing at the time, right?
Exactly. Whereas since then, I think there's been a shift away from that pure possession football towards pressing, which is about running. It's about regaining the ball high up the pitch. To a certain extent, it's about tackling. And that suits us more. So I think that was an entirely fair comment. I think we were going down a road that we didn't necessarily have the players for that. And I think now football's changed and we've, you know, maybe changed slightly with the times. This England side, to me, feels more suited to modern football, not just because we have better players than we did 5 or 6 years ago, but because it's about mobility, it's about pressing, it's about energy. And we've got a lot of guys, particularly in the attacking section of the side,
that can do that.
That can do that. Mm. Yeah.
And you're obviously possibly uniquely placed to be able to identify these trends, how they've happened over the years. I mean, you've literally written the book, two books on it. What do you think is the direction of football now? What's going to be the next big tactical iteration? Because I think it might be tempting to think that every time something new happens, oh, this is, nothing else can happen after this. There's nowhere left to go. What direction do you see it moving in?
Well, I think the interesting thing now is, you know, there was the rise of possession football. Then there was a rise of pressing, which was almost a response to that, try and get the ball off them quickly. And now I think the question is how you overcome the press. And I think the most interesting manager in this regard is Sarri at Chelsea, who hasn't really been able to carry out his ideas as he wants at Chelsea. But when you look at his Napoli side and a couple of goals that Chelsea have scored this season, they're using possession to tempt the press. You know, they
and
want
bypassing
they,
it.
Yeah, they, so they they're not trying to go, oh God, this is scary. We need to just work our way through this. They're using the press to create the space and working it through quickly. And I think that's really interesting. It's there was a goal they scored against Man City. I think it was Kante scored at Stamford Bridge, where you saw that really obviously. They had the ball in the back four and they just played sideways passes until City pushed up the game, pushed up the pitch. And then they transferred the ball really quickly through it. So I think it will be about, I don't really know what you call that. It's almost like counter-attacking with possession,
yeah,
if that makes sense.
Setting the trap. But I mean, would it not be as effective to do that and then play almost like a long ball style to bypass it as quickly as possible?
Sure, so that's what happened in that move. Mm. You know, David Luiz hit a diagonal ball and you've seen that a lot. I always thought David Luiz's passing ability, I always thought was a bit overrated. Mm. You kind of see someone who can't defend very well and you think, well, they must be great on the ball. Mm. I wasn't always convinced by that.
No.
But I think his passing this season within that system
has been
fantastic, yeah.
He gets a lot of stick, doesn't he?
He does make silly errors. I mean, it's difficult to get past that. But he is very well suited to what Sarri wants to do.
Okay, great. What's next for you, Michael? What any Dan's you're going to try and... I know you want a little bit of a break now. You've written this book, which was a big project for you. But is there any danger you're going to cover the game in a slightly different way? Is there any other areas of football that you're interested in? Or is it you're going to stick with what you know?
I mean, no plans to do anything vastly different. But I think one thing that maybe is underestimated or maybe not covered enough is everyone's commented on, you know, like the size of City's backroom staff and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think just going more in depth into what those people do and you kind of know what their job is, but in a way you don't know how that information is fed to players.
That's a hugely changed part of the game, which I tried to cover a while ago. I did a book review of Michael Calvert's Living on the Volcano. Have you read that?
Yeah,
he goes around different managers around the country. And he kind of speaks to these guys who are all things to all men. They're like, one day they're a psychologist, the next day they're a groundsman, one of them's buying a net off eBay to put up on the thing. And as I was researching it, I saw that Guardiola's got 21 backroom staff. And that is a huge change to what we would consider traditionally football management to do. I mean, he's essentially managing a team who's managing a team. And that's a huge change, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. And there's so many kind of real specialist areas now that you find. I mean, there's, you know, the lengths that football clubs go to make their players comfortable these days. Isn't it? I mean, even, I don't know if you've read about this, but a lot of teams are kind of, for away trips, they're transporting the players' bedding around. Like around the world to make them have a better sleep and make them feel comfortable.
This is this Dave Brailsford kind of aggregated marginal gains type of philosophy, right?
For sure, yeah. And the number of, I mean, the interesting thing is, or the uninteresting thing is, often these guys can't talk about it, but they're doing like really niche, really specific things.
Yeah. I wonder if you would ever consider, whether maybe you have in the past, I don't know, whether you would consider consulting for football clubs about on the tactical side and helping them, maybe dedicating the time to looking at the tactics in a way that's slightly different, a fresh pair of eyes kind of thing. Would you be interested in that?
No, to be honest, I think football clubs have so many people working for them and at a really high level now. That I think 10 years ago, that was an area that they weren't covering particularly well. But these clubs have like a lot of data analysts and a lot of a lot of tactics guys, and the brain power there is huge. Mm. Again, it's a question of how it's transferred to the manager and how it's transferred to the players. I mean, I remember Man City are quite ahead of the game on this. I remember when they sacked Mancini and brought in Pellegrini and they released a statement saying they wanted to work in a more holistic way.
I saw that, yeah.
And everyone found that really funny, and it's like a bit of a, it's not the kind
of... It's a wanky term, but it's a perfectly reasonable thing to say.
Yeah, it's not the kind of word that you want to be hearing your football club using, really.
No.
But about a year later, I was at this Opta pro forum, they call it, where there's kind of a meeting between lots of guys who work in the statistical side of football. And they had a really interesting presentation from one of their stats guys who didn't use that phrase, but it was almost showing how they put together a training session. They have the data guys, they analyze the data. They found out that, I think they were playing Tottenham, and they found that of all the Premier League sides, Tottenham's two central midfielders played a higher proportion of passes than any other side. Mm. So then they fed that back to the training ground and had a training ground exercise where it was about pressing these two central midfielders, and you could leave the fullbacks open, but you were always on the central midfielders. Mm. So that was a kind of, that's quite a basic thing now, but that was an example of how it is a holistic process. You do have information from lots of different parts of the club, and it's up to the manager or the sporting director in some cases to amalgamate this together and formulate a game plan.
But there's no place for you at the top table.
I don't think so. I think there's. I think clubs are pretty sorted for people like me. And
you'll have to stick to writing books, then, won't you?
Pretty much. Yeah,
Michael, thanks so much for your time. It's been fascinating, as it always is, and I appreciate you coming in. And I hope your book does well. I'm sure it will. If you're still listening at this point, get Zonal Marking by Michael Cox. Pick it up. It's out on the came out on the 30th of May, didn't it?
So yes,
it's available in all good bookshops.
Yes.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks.
This episode of Ramble Meets was sponsored by Bet365.
This was a Radio Staccato production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Anna Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.